G'day, this is Hamish McTaggart from Vigimaya Station, and this is the Country Hour on the ABC.
Well, hi there, 12:05, Belinda Varaschetti with you here on ABC WA. This is the Country Hour. Great to have you along this hour. After 12:30 today, and really keen to hear from you if you're in the business of growing fruit. Because if you are, there is a conversation going on at the moment. It's come up again because this has happened several times over the years where the Fair Work Commission has a look at the overtime issue, what workers are paid, not just in the fruit business, but it is of particular concern if you are in the business of growing fruit because that is so labour intensive. And the conversation today is around when does overtime kick in? And the Fair Work Commission thinks at the end of a 38-hour week, that is the time when workers should be paid overtime. What would that mean to your business? It's a proposal at this stage. It hasn't been implemented, but the talk is certainly heating up around this issue. After 12:30, you'll hear from a couple of fruit growers here in Western Australia, what it would mean to them as a larger size business, a smaller business, but keen to hear from you and what it would mean to you too. Does it mean more hours? Does the family spend more time doing that work rather than getting extra workers on the property? Let me know. 0448 922 604, and we'll get to those texts after 12:30 today. Of course, the big news today is looking ahead towards that cold front. Should be crossing the state around about sunset tomorrow. All the latest, the update, where that rain might fall, how much might be in it with the Weather Bureau just after 12:30 today. And the other big news in rural circles around Australia today is that Australia's largest cattle company, AA Co., has announced it will mothball its abattoir outside of Darwin. The Australian Agricultural Company has today released its yearly financial results, which outline plans to shut the doors on its $100 million processing facility. The CEO is Hugh Killen, and he's here to explain the reasons behind this decision.
Look, we've taken decisive action on Livingston Beef to make sure we maintain long-term shareholder returns. We've been running a review on the plant now for a couple of months, and on the basis of review and the input from that, we made a decision to cease processing. So what that means in English is we're going to start to wind down our production there, make sure we meet our key customer commitments, and most importantly, I think, is make sure that we support our staff in the plant as well.
So wind down, when will we actually see the doors shut?
Look, we've got commitments through to late August at this point, Lydia. I'd expect we'll be fully finished by September 30, if not earlier.
It's only 3 years since the abattoir opened. Why can't it make money, Hugh Killen?
It's been a challenging business for AA Co. Operating a plant in the north is not without its challenges. They include both the climate with the wet, they include generally high or elevated cow prices. We've seen a rebuild of the cow herd going on in the last couple of years. Labour input costs here, amongst other input costs in the plant, are relatively high compared to southern processing facilities as well. So all of that, when you combine that with running a very large fixed asset, has meant that we've struggled to make profit out of it. So the decision today, it's one around financials, not around our people.
Your predecessors knew all of those challenges, and yet they were optimistic and they invested a lot to get this facility up and running. So where did it all go wrong?
My decisions today are around the future. So we're taking decisive action here to stem the losses in Livingston Beef and then put into a point where we can retain shareholder value in the future. In terms of the decisions we've taken in the past, for me, not a fruitful conversation, really, and I want to focus on building future value in the company, including the unique assets that we have and our unique value proposition around branded beef at scale.
Now, you've been down at the abattoir this morning speaking with employees. How were they reacting to what you had to say?
It's been a really tough morning, Lydia. I think for me, it's been terribly sad. I flew overnight to make sure I was at the plant this morning myself, and so there is obviously an impact on people. And as the message I gave them at the plant today, my absolute focus now is on them and ensuring that we do the right thing by them and helping them through what's going to be a difficult transition. So the mood is very sombre We have a lot of very good people there that invested a huge amount of time in making the plant a success, and it's extremely sad and painful that we've had to make this decision.
The last 3 years, it's, you know, been a bit of a beef boom across Australia. We've seen record high cattle prices. You know, cattle producers down on the ground, they've reported some of their best profits ever. Why is Australia's biggest cattle company losing money?
I think if you look at the strategy the company's been employing over the last couple of years, it's been transitioning from a farm gate cattle business to an integrated beef business. And, you know, we haven't been selling cattle in this environment. In fact, you know, the last 3 years ago, the company was a net purchaser of cattle to put into a branded beef program. So one of the decisions we've made is obviously to close our supply chain. And so we're less exposed to the fluctuations of the cattle market and selling branded beef into market. So that'd be first one. And then number two, we've already discussed the impact of Livingston Beef on the business over the last couple of years, and we've obviously disclosed that. And obviously, you know, the short-fed program as well has been expensive for the company as well.
You say the luxury beef products, the results there are pleasing. Does that mean that we will see an increase in those types of cattle produced?
Absolutely. We've put our herd disclosure in this year, and we've got, you know, in terms of the cattle that we put through our Wagyu and F1 supply chain, that's where we'll continue to focus. Those numbers will stay relatively steady, but we'll be focusing on making sure that we have the supply chain best lined up to deliver branded beef into the markets where we operate at a higher margin.
Now, finally, you appointed a chief operating officer, announced yesterday. Anna Speer is going to step into the role. She's obviously well known for her role as CEO of Auctions Plus. What do you hope she brings to the company and to the role?
I think Anna's going to bring an energy and enthusiasm to the change agenda that I'm trying to put through to the business from the get-go. I've really attracted to Anna's success in Auctions Plus, which at the end of the day is a disruptive marketplace in terms of thinking about how you do things differently. And when you think about what we're trying to do, we're trying to solve a margin problem as well, which requires, you know, a big focus on technology and data and analytics and some of the skills that Anna's brought to bear at Auctions Plus, which has been highly successful. You know, I think that she can transition that across to AACo, and I think she's someone that can be a key executive for us and absolutely grow into that role and be a key executive in AACo in the future. So we're very excited in having her on board.
Hugh Killen, he's the CEO of the Australian Agricultural Company, talking there to the ABC's Lydia Burton about the company's plans announced today that it's going to mothball its abattoir just outside of Darwin. 12 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Just of note, the next abattoir for the north is Townsville. Or, of course, there is Jack Burton's abattoir near Broome, and you'll hear from Jack Burton in just a moment.
Have your say on the Country Hour. SMS the program on 0448 922 604.
East Kimberley pastoralists say they're disappointed by AACo's decision to close its Darwin abattoir. Sophie Downs Station, which is near Halls Creek, sends up to 200 cattle to Darwin for slaughter just towards the end of every season. Pastoralist Lynette Craig says it's going to have a small impact on her family's business, which has relied on the abattoir as an outlet to send feral bulls.
It will affect us to a small degree. We usually just send over those cattle, you know, say feral bulls or something that we can't sell anywhere else, and it's usually not toward later in the year. So it's not going to have a great impact, but it will have an impact on us because, you know, we usually sell, say, 5-6 decks, or just depends how many bulls, how dry the season's been and how many bulls we've had. We muster some fairly rugged countries, and that's been an outlet for us to send our feral bulls.
And every year, depending on the season you've had, that could be, what sort of numbers would you be sending over there?
Well, sometimes we've sold, you know, say 200 in one hit, but not every year.
And what would be the next best option, I suppose, for you? There is the Yeeda Abattoir down in the West Kimberley there. Is that another option for you, or do you know where you may go from here if it shuts in Darwin?
Well, I'm not sure what we'd do. I guess you could say that the abattoir in the West Kimberley is an option. I'm not sure whether we would go there or not.
Lynette Craig. She's from Sophie Downs Station in the East Kimberley, catching up with the ABC's Courtney Fowler. 12:15. Well, Jack Burton is the owner of that West Kimberley Meatworks, Kimberley Meat Company, which is the processing facility just situated about halfway between Broome and Derby. And his phone has been ringing hot today following the news that AA Co. will mothball its Darwin abattoir. The Kimberley abattoir was opened, well, a few years back, late 2016, and is the first major abattoir to operate in this region, in the Kimberley, since 1993. Jack Burton, what does AA Co.'s decision mean for your business?
Well, the implications for our business is obviously that, you know, there's cattle that will now be looking for somewhere to be processed. You know, that leaves a pretty big hole in the north for processing slaughter cattle. So, yeah, look, I mean, as much as it's a negative for the industry, I think it's probably a positive thing for our business.
If AA Co., the size of a company like that, Jack Burton, can't make it work, what are the implications for other businesses like yours to continue for the long term?
Oh, look, I think it's probably an indictment on, you know, corporatisation. I think, you know, we're a bit of a family business and a sort of, you know, on a different level. Our plant's a lot smaller. We don't need as many cattle every day to make it work. We've got a lot smaller crew. We're a fairly different type of beast. So I think the implications are, you know, I think it's probably a lesson that we want to be careful, you know, that in the north, too big might not be too good sometimes. It's certainly, you know, keep it small and keep it nimble and look, our business is doing really well at the moment. We're at full capacity, so we're pretty happy.
So with that in mind and that sort of thought process that you have about running a business in the north of Australia, did you expect this would happen? You don't sound so surprised by AA Co.'s decision today.
Oh, look, I've never known and expected it there. I think, you know, it had its naysayers. I mean, I've always been fully supportive of it. I think we need this in our, you know, in this space. We don't want to be back to the good old days of being fully reliant on live export. I think, you know, having abattoirs and live export, like the two businesses are very complementary. I think it's, you know, it's a sad day, but it's just, I'm sure that, you know, they'll probably look at it at some point in the future and fire it up again.
Well, AA Co. has said today that the facility is going to be maintained at a level that would allow processing to restart should the market conditions improve while keeping those costs to a minimum. How do you see the market conditions?
Oh, look, I mean, they're okay. There's a prison at the moment. It's a simple equation of what you pay and what you get and what it costs you to do it. So, look, it's just a mathematical equation. We're certainly, like I say, you know, our operations are a lot less top-heavy. You know, we're a different, totally different sort of thing. It's very hard to compare our operation with the AA operation in a lot of ways.
So how tight are the margins, the market? You know, is there a real squeeze on the situation? Or because, as you're highlighting, you're a very different operation set up to what a big corporate like AA Co. is, so it's quite a different set of circumstances.
Yeah, look, I mean, my philosophy is the best way to make a dollar is not spend it in the first place. So a little bit of a different philosophy there. But it's just interesting how things pan out. But certainly, we're certainly on the other end of the spectrum. We're keen as mustard to put more through our plant and do more. We're pretty excited about the space we're in at the moment. Like I say, on a purely sort of looking at our own operation, you know, this is probably good for our business in some ways, but I think probably not that good for the whole industry.
What about capacity? Where are things at, Jack, at your place, at your processing plant? Are you able to take on any more, considering what's already going through the system at the moment?
Well, yeah, we're at full capacity at the moment. We're obviously going to assess the situation and see what sort of supply sort of comes onto the table, and then we'll make that decision whether we look at doing extra time or extra shifts or whatever. But look, it's totally relative to, you know, what it's going to cost us to get cattle to our plant and what it's going to cost us to, put them through the plant. So we'll make that assessment depending on, you know, what sort of a hole this leaves. And I'm not sure when AA Co. are talking about stopping, but, I mean, that's all sort of going to be factored in and we'll have a look at that as we go forward.
So what sort of numbers going through being processed on a weekly basis?
Yeah, we're doing about 1,100 to 1,200 a week at the moment, which is very comfortable for us. So, you know, we're getting the cattle, we're putting them through and we're getting them sold at a profit. So, you know, we're certainly happy with where we are. You know, there's obviously a finite number of cattle around the place and we've got to get it, you know, we want to sort of extend our season as much as we can. So So, yeah, just we'll sort of have a look at it. Hopefully, you know, some of them territory cattle in the second half of the year will become available, which will make us be able to push further through the wet season.
With the question mark now over the future of the livestock export market, the live trade out of Australia, and there's the private members bill put forward in Parliament and several politicians stating the case for phasing out the industry. Is it even more important than ever that this continues, this processing side in the north of Australia?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I think you've just hit the nail on the head. You know, having all your chicken, all your eggs in one basket is certainly not the way to go. I think, you know, the abattoir, like I say, they're very complimentary. And we'll obviously be looking at opportunities, you know, if the live export job sort of maintains, you know, its sort of current sort of basically a bit of lack of confidence, we'll be looking at what we can do with them type of cattle. I'd love nothing more than to be able to compete with live export and feed cattle and put them through our plant, then freight them into Southeast Asia to them same markets. I think, that, you know, we're in a pretty good space at the moment at the yield of pastoral company level. And but I certainly wouldn't want to see that, you know, like to see the industry healthy and everyone doing well, because that's the main game, to get supply if everyone's doing well.
Have you had any calls this morning, Jack, in relation to the AACo decision?
Yeah, look, there's been a bit of interest from some territory guys. Obviously, they're a bit worried about where they're going to be going. You know, they've got a fairly long haul back to the east as an alternative, so they're hedging their bets. So look, there, it's a bit of activity at the moment as the news gets out. And like I say, in a lot of ways, it could be a great thing for us. So I'm just going to work at how we can make it work for us and everyone else.
Jack Burton, great to talk to you. Thanks for your time on the Country Hour today.
Thanks, Linda. Talk to you later.
Jack Burton is from the Yeda Pastoral Company, and he's the owner of the Kimberley Meat Company. That's the cattle processing facility just outside of Broome here in WA. And that's off the decision today. Jack Burton just commenting after AACo decided that it's going to close its abattoir in Darwin over the next coming while. We'll just put it, mothball it really, just wind everything right down. There is the option to, you know, if things get better and AACo thinks, well, you know, maybe now's the time to reopen. There is that possibility, but at this stage it's certainly in the wind down process. 22 past 12 and on text 0448 922 604. Matt says, and with one business decision, this company, AACo, has shown why live export is in existence. Processing costs here are too high to make money. Checking in with the news headlines and a look at the weather very shortly here on ABC WA.
This is the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
It's a bit unusual to be talking fire threats so late in May. And in a few minutes, a warning for you about the fire risk associated with storms forecast for this weekend. But first, a southwest dairy farmer had a close call with a fire just yesterday. Ross Woodhouse was helping backburn some blue gums near his property at Carradale, just south of Alexandra Bridge, when the fire jumped a decent width brake line. And he says they were just so fortunate that emergency services responded so quickly.
Just the wind picked up, I think, and it jumped a fairly significant fire break. I'm not sure what width, but it was quite clean, and then it got into the vegetation on the side of the road, on the northern side of the road, and then jumped across to the southern side of the road into the bush, the cycle reserve surrounding the Alexander Bridge Hall. So we were quite lucky, really. Had it, you know, had we not had rain earlier in the year and so on, it could have been potentially quite bad.
You've obviously got a dairy farm out there. How is everything there?
Oh, look, it's fine, yeah. Look, it was going in the opposite direction, and really it was, in the scheme of things, it wasn't a serious fire. It could potentially be like all fires, but the local fire brigade were onto it quite quickly, and some of the local contractors and so on all hopped in, and it was out quite quickly.
It was, but there is also a Kianina stud, a beef stud down that way, I understand, and also a few wineries. Do you know if they're okay?
Yeah, the Kianina stud actually backs onto the bush, and yeah, I think that's... From my understanding, it's all good now. Yeah, the local fire brigade were pretty active and were fairly fortunate. A contractor with a tanker load of water came along just as the fire sort of jumped, and he helped dampen it down a little bit to stop it spreading. So it was sort of a good team effort, really. So.
Yeah, and in hindsight, is there anything that you could have done to stop that?
We were back burning, so we didn't have water on hand. So, yes, I'd say But, you know, we've been burning for the last week or 10 days and not had any issues, you know, so we didn't sort of, I guess, the prolonged dry, it's actually sort of reverting back to being a sort of a risky situation again. You know, the bush is quite dry. We've had over 100 mils of rain so far this year. It's been perfect conditions for cleaning up, burning up any logs and so on, because it's damp enough to be green and dry enough to get the fires to burn. So it's sort of a good fuel reduction type environment, you know, without a lot of risk. But this was just one of those events, I think.
So no real damage to properties or fences, etc., just to the bush. So lucky escape this time round. Southwest dairy farmer Ross Woodhouse with Tyne Logan and telling her and you about how quickly backburning can get out of control. And he says they've been backburning that area for about 3 months. Well, Ross and his neighbours weren't the only ones having problems with hazard reduction burns yesterday. Some burning in a pine plantation near Augusta turned into an emergency situation. The winds picked up and suddenly lives and homes were being threatened. Danny Moscone is the acting superintendent for the Lower Southwest. And he says in the last 3 weeks, in their patch alone, they've had over 30 escaped burns. So he's worried about the cold front that's on its way.
We've been monitoring that weather event pretty closely for the past few days, and we'll keep an eye on that today and certainly into tomorrow. But with that cold front that's expected to cross the southwest capes, probably tomorrow evening, I think it is, it's expected to bring strong winds. And that's our concern, because there are a number of active burns that potentially could escape. So probably two key messages I'd like to get out there is that anyone who has conducted a burn on their property over the past week or so, just go and check it and make sure that it's safe and it's cold and it's blacked out. And then the other key message I want to get out there is that I strongly encourage people not to begin any burns until after this cold front's passed and we've had a bit of rain. And hopefully there will be some more opportunities to reduce fuels on properties after this rain event.
We've seen reports of absentee landowners actually coming down, lighting their piles and then jumping back in the car, heading back to Perth. Have you heard similar reports?
I have, and that's very irresponsible. And people need to understand that 99% of our responders are volunteers, so very irresponsible if people are doing that and then expecting volunteers to leave their families, give up their weekends to go and control a fire that is unnecessary. But the key message, though, is that it's fantastic people are taking responsibility to try and reduce fuel loads around their homes. They need to take some precautions and be responsible.
Danny Moscone is the acting superintendent for the Lower Southwest, talking to the ABC's Stan Shaw. Wayne Green is the superintendent with DFES in the Great Southern, and he has the same concerns as Danny, because just 2 weeks ago, his region had 53 fires in one weekend. 37 escaped from private burns.
Yeah, hopefully we've picked up a few learning points from a couple of weeks ago, and that we can get anyone with private property burns that they've got currently going to make them safe by extinguishing them by Thursday. I believe City of Albany is enforcing that they make it by tonight, Wednesday evening, to make sure that they're all extinguished and safe, ready for the winds that we're expecting.
So what's your advice then? Should people be undertaking burns today?
No, so today it'll be up to individual local governments to review the weather conditions in their areas. Obviously, the Great Southern's a massive region, so we've just sent a blanket suggestion across to the local governments that we have got these winds coming. We've experienced, you know, winds a couple of weeks ago where we had 30 plus escaped private burn fires. Yesterday we've seen an emergency warning issued, I believe. So
that was Augusta way, was it? How surprising was that for that to happen, you know, May 22?
Look, it's just, you know, I won't say it's unheard of, but it's very unusual for this time of the year. And yeah, the conditions are, you know, nice and dry, but that's not nice, and you know, for our farmers and everything else, we need some rain to come through. Unfortunately, it's not coming at the moment. Without that rain, our bushland, everything is so bone dry at the moment. And
dry is it? You've got a dryness index.
We
is
do.
It off the charts,
got, it is. It's the driest it has been on record in a couple of locations across the Great Southern.
Which locations are they?
Look, inland of us, definitely. There's quite a few fire districts across the Great Southern. But consistently all the way across to Esperance, we're experiencing very, very dry conditions, and all the way up to our northeast corner. the local government of Denmark actually had to suspend a burn a couple of weeks ago, purely because of the fire behaviour that they experienced in their test portion of that prescription. So then they delayed it for cooler and wetter conditions.
You got resources at the ready?
Look, that's another big thing at the moment, Andrew. All of our resources are, but they've been so busy. So that's the other side of this picture is cities like Albany haven't been able to commit to their own prescribed burning program purely because their resources are committed chasing escape burns. Now, those resources, you know, we can't keep flogging our volunteers to death. So while they're out chasing escape private burns, they're not being able to assist the city in achieving their prescribed burns, making, you know, sure that we're safer for next summer, which isn't that far away, really.
Wayne Green, he's a superintendent with DFES in the Great Southern, and talking there to the ABC's Andrew Collins. It's 12:30 here on the Country Hour. After the news headlines and a look at the weather around Western Australia, and particular attention on that cold front heading our way, what's in it for you will be revealed shortly. And then talking about what workers should be paid and at what point they should be paid overtime, and looking particularly at casual fruit pickers, this is, because this is being put under the spotlight by the Fair Work Commission. And at this point, it looks like at the end of a 38-hour week, that's when the commission believes that overtime should be paid. What would that mean to your business? Looking at that after 12:30. This on Facebook from Phil, who says, another journalist student looking for clickbait about a made-up story. Well, no, it's not made up, Phil. The industry is talking about this issue, and so are the apple growers that you will hear from after 12:30. Michaela Carr in the studio with the news headlines.
Thanks, Belinda. The police minister says the force is reviewing its vetting processes in light of issues with disgraced former MP Barry Urban. Police are investigating Mr Urban partly in relation to claims he made in his application to become an officer prior to being elected as an MP. The opening of the new Perth Stadium pedestrian footbridge won't go ahead in May and is now expected a month later. The Transport Minister Rita Saffiotti has blamed weather conditions for the latest delay. A 35-year-old Perth man has been remanded in custody after appearing in court charged with murder. Paul Alexander Wilson has been charged with the murder of Alastair Wilson in Queen's Park. And in basketball, Houston has defeated Golden State in Game 4 of the NBA's Western Conference Finals Series. The Rockets rallied in the final term to win the match 95-92. The series is now tied at 2-2 with Game 5 in Houston on Friday. Belle, I'll be back with news at 1 o'clock.
Look forward to it, Michaela. Thank you for those details. 28-1.
This is the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio, WA.
You can be part of the conversation this afternoon on text 0448 922 604. This just through. Be careful not to talk up this pending rain for ag areas, as nothing is as heartbreaking as hanging your hopes on rain like this, only to see it only fall on the west coast and not make it over the Darling Scarp. Let's hope this front doesn't turn out to be a politician full of promise on the way in, but once they get here, we find out they're just full of wind. Really not trying to talk it up too much, but it is really the first sign of some rain that we've seen for these areas in quite some time. Off to the Weather Bureau now. Noel Pusey's been paying it a lot of attention today in the lead up to talking to you this afternoon. Noel, should we start in northern and eastern parts to just see what's happening there over the next few days?
Okay. Well, northern eastern parts, Belinda, it's high pressure ridge still lies over southeastern Australia. There's still been some easterly winds up through northern parts of the state and also probably through eastern parts too, and quite dry in the west, as you probably seen for the last week or so anyway. But look, it's the high is moving east, and for the next few days at least, little in the way of rainfall for eastern parts of the state, perhaps until sort of Friday or Saturday, when some shower activity may reach just parts of the Eucla, I think, through there. But I've really got to talk about the cold front in relation to western parts of the Pilbara as well, because it is a strong cold front. It is going to stand up quite vertically north-south along the west coast during Thursday afternoon and evening, and it will bring some shower activity through much of the western half of the state, I think. It includes the Pilbara, so it's not too often you can say you've got a decent cold front moving through the Pilbara, at least western parts, but that's going to be the case over the next few days. And I think the rainfall will be pretty reasonable for most parts, but perhaps in particular ahead of the rainfall, very strong and gusty northerly winds over much of the state, really, and quite gusty at times through any parts of the Gascoyne and South West Land Division, you'd like to name through there, and some severe fire dangers through there as well. But I think there may well also be areas of some raised dust, of course, with this very dry conditions being replaced by wet conditions. But in the meantime, some wind blowing some of the topsoil away to the south, unfortunately. But the front itself looks good, and I'm going to raise the hopes of people because I think it's a reasonable start to the season, and it will be the rains that we haven't seen for the last month or so anyway. Falls near the west coast, sort of 15 to 30 millimetres, ice or 50 millimetres in places there, perhaps around the South West Capes in particular. But the front stays together and does move through all of the South West Land Division into the Goldfields by the early hours of Friday morning. And I think there'll be a some reasonable rainfall over most agricultural areas, probably in the order of 10 to 15 millimetres to the east of Cunderdon and tapering off a little bit perhaps to the eastern boundary of the central wheat belt, but other parts of the Great Southern, Central West, the Lower West and the South West, South Coastal districts all get pretty decent falls of rain with showers and thunderstorms embedded in that too.
And yesterday when we were talking to the Weather Bureau, it looked like the you know, getting into double digits would sort of hit around the 20 mil mark, but you're saying in some parts that could be 50. Can you be more specific about where that might be, Noel?
Look, it's, it, as I said, around 50 mils to along the west coast, essentially, and maybe up to 70 around the southwest capes there. The sort of area there is sort of prone to heavy rainfall, and with this sort of stream effect of showers and thunderstorms moving through that period and perhaps extending a little bit further, lasting longer in that area there, the falls will be heavier. But I wouldn't be surprised to see, look, 10 to 15 millimetres through most of the South West Land Division and a little bit more than that in western parts at least anyway.
All right, so most parts, any area looks like missing out at this point?
Not particularly. I mean, the falls over the southeast coastal district and perhaps into the Goldfields will be lighter through there. So I think they'll have plenty of wind, unfortunately, ahead of the front. But maybe not so much in the way of rainfall there. But most other parts will get some rainfall, and perhaps the main hope as well is that we'll go into a westerly flow in the wake of this front for the next few days. So shower activity will continue mainly in the southwest capes and coastal parts along the south coast. There is another weak front pushing up through Sunday morning that'll bring some showers southwest of Lyne, roughly Durian Bay to Esperance, and some light falls in that. But we see a brief ridge coming after that, but the main thing to note is that we look like we'll have a follow-up front late next week as well, another quite reasonable front. So it's not a one-off event, and so hopefully this might be the start of some decent growing period anyway.
All right, it's sounding good. What about those winds, Noel? What sort of strength might they be?
Well, there's strong to gale force winds, particularly in coastal areas, I think, through there. Strong winds over the land are quite possible. Sort of be quite extended areas of 20 knot winds, so sort of 40 to 50 kilometre hour winds with gusts to 70. Stronger near the capes and around the west coast, and there will be a strong severe weather warning issued for basically those destructive and damaging gusts from this afternoon, from about 4 p.m. But the main area will be on the leading edge of this front as it moves through during tomorrow evening. And there will also be higher than normal tides because the winds and the northerly winds pushing into areas like Geograph Bay in particular and along the west coast will hold the tides up and also increase the sort of tides to higher than normal sort of conditions for this time of the year.
Any warnings current?
Strong wind and gale warnings current, really all for tomorrow at the moment, from northwest Cape all the way across towards Eyre near the South Australian border. Gales from round about Kalbarri to Windy Harbour at the moment, and they will change through the next few days as the front moves through.
Noel, thank you for going through that in some detail this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Linda.
Noel Pusey with the details. 21 to 1, checking the rainfall figures the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. Nothing across Western Australia in that time period. It looks like things might change a little later in the week. I hope it comes your way if you need it.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
When should casual fruit pickers be paid overtime? That is the question that the Fair Work Commission is currently having a look at and wants the answer to. And fruit grower groups are saying that they just can't afford to pay overtime. But the unions say employees are entitled to be paid more if they work long hours. Phil Turnbull is the CEO of Apple and Pear Australia, and his argument is the horticulture industry has unique requirements when it comes to farm labour, and this proposal is not a good fit.
It started back in 2014 when there was a four-yearly review commenced around the Modern Award. The issue that's relating to the Hort Award is that of overtime being paid to casuals. And so there's been a number of steps in that, including a joint effort from Voice of Horticulture and NFF to try and prepare a statement and a position around the Hort's payment of overtime. And so, yeah, at the moment we've got a situation where the Fair Work Commission has handed down their provisional view. And that's been obviously reviewed by employer parties such as ourselves and the NFF.
Is it something that is causing a bit of confusion amongst growers at the moment?
I think so, because it's an ongoing situation that's been running for a couple of years, and it hasn't actually been clarified. And as was stated in our explanation, it is still a provisional view, so we're not yet certain where it's going to land.
What is the position that the Fair Work Commission has taken at the moment when it comes to overtime rights for casual workers?
So the Fair Work Commission, in their provisional view, decided that that overtime should be payable to casuals, and the specifics of that it would be at a rate of time and a half, with ordinary hours limited to 12 hours per day between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m., 304 hours over 8 weeks. And I guess the concern from apple and pear growers' point of view is that we tend to have a reasonably long season. So, you know, our pear growers can start in January and they can still be harvesting apples in May, towards the end of May. So the concern for us really was that the averaging period of 8 weeks really doesn't actually sit comfortably with our much longer harvesting period.
You're concerned that growers would have to pay overtime?
That's right. I mean, the situation would be that for their casual employees, if they work greater than 304 hours over an eight-week period, then they would be required to pay them overtime. And I guess the concern that we have is that growers are unlikely to employ casuals greater than 38 hours a week over an eight-week period in that situation, because unless they're in a position to pass on the cost. And, you know, we've had some challenging market conditions over the last couple of years, so it's unlikely that our growers will absorb that cost. And the other concern for us is that the demand for more workers because of that inability to employ people greater than 38 hours will exacerbate an existing labour shortage issue. So that's a concern for us.
Shouldn't workers be entitled to be paid more, though, if they are working above and beyond their regular hours?
In horticulture, for a variety of reasons, there's a number of casual employees who want to work for short, intense periods, whether they're backpackers or it's part of the seasonal worker program. And a lot of the apple and pear orchards that we represent are in areas where people arrive and don't really want to do anything but work for short, hard periods. But then they might have a period of a week where they don't work. So the situation is that were our growers in a position to pay additional overtime, then that's possible. But the reality is that the economics just don't support a situation where we can pay for overtime. So I think the way it'll unfold will be that there will be requirement for more labour in those regions.
And so I gather too that these proposed changes as they stand at the moment wouldn't affect piecework rates, where workers are paid by how much they pick.
That's right.
Could growers just switch to that then, just use that as the option instead of an hourly rate?
And look, that is largely the case. There are situations where piecework doesn't actually make sense. So there'll be certain types of roles where you're not picking or doing work per unit. So not all seasonal labour is based around piecework. So in those situations, that's where our growers are facing cost increases.
So you've built up a kind of alternative proposal with the National Farmers Federation. So how does that differ to what the Fair Work Commission's looking at?
What we're asking for is something that really makes more sense in the realities of the horticultural industry, particularly around seasonal work. So the suggestion is still 12 hours a day, but what we're looking at is over a longer averaging period, so 6 months, and that really reflects the nature of particularly the apple and pear harvest, where at the as I said, we might be in January when we're harvesting pears, we might still be harvesting apples towards the end of May. So that then will make sense for our seasonal work programs and also for our backpackers in relation to casual hours.
Is there a risk that this could just be seen as growers wanting to minimise how much they pay their workers, given that that is a bit of a controversial area at the moment anyway?
The situation is that we're finding it hard to get seasonal work at the moment. We're getting anecdotal information from our growers to say that they are not getting the casual work that they need to get their harvest. So we see a situation where at the moment we've got a lot of growers who are prepared to employ people on a casual basis, and particularly with things like the seasonal worker programs where they're having workers come back year after year, there's obviously a good relationship there. What we're seeing is this is potentially going to jeopardise that. So that's a real concern for us.
Phil Turnbull, he's the CEO of Apple and Pear Australia, talking to Nikolai Bailharts. 14 to 1. Well, Paul Good manages operation and market development at Newton Orchards at Manjimup, and he's also on the APAL board. Paul, you've got quite a big player. You're quite a big player in the industry here in Western Australia. Can you give us a sense of the scale of the operation?
So how are you going, Belinda? Look, we produce about 7,000 tonnes a year of apples and pears, and most of that fruit goes straight into Coles and Woolworths, and a little bit of that goes to export. I suppose we've got about 150 staff during our busy season, and then during our off season we've got about 50 staff. So, yeah, that's about where we sit in terms of employment.
All right, so what would this mean to you if suddenly at the end of a 38-hour week, when your workers get to that point and you had to pay overtime, what would it mean?
Look, we're petrified of it, to tell the truth. We think most of the horticultural industry is probably, they've got a return on investment of somewhere between 5 and maybe 20% at best. We're estimating that this will be a cost increase of our wages. And I think in horticulture, wages for most businesses will be the largest expense. So we think that'll be a cost increase to our business of somewhere between 10 to 30%. And to be honest, we just don't have that fat left.
So how do you work into the equation when you've got workers on the place doing the extra time if they're not being paid overtime when they reach the 38-hour week point? What's your plan?
No, well, I guess there's two options. One, you can go and double the size of your staff, but that's not an easy option because, for example, during apple harvest that's going on at the moment, we've got 10 tractors out there in the field every day servicing about 100 pickets. Now, if we went back to 38 hours, we'd have to double all that infrastructure. So it's double the number of tractors, it's double the number of supervisors, it's double the number of QC managers that we've got. So it would be a huge cost input into our business that we think we can't afford.
All right, so what would you do if suddenly overnight that was introduced at 38 hours a week, you'd then have to pay overtime? What would happen at your place?
Well, that's a scenario that we're going to have to work out how to do it. To be honest, we're not quite sure how we're going to stomach it yet.
Okay, can you pass the costs on to supermarkets, to the consumers?
No, absolutely not. It was interesting. We had one of the large retailers here the other day, and they were saying, right, how can we reduce prices at the till for the Australian consumer? How do we get product cheaper? Well, I said, well, we've got a 3% increase coming on the 1st of July, and then potentially with the changes to the award, we're going to have somewhere between a 10 to 30%. So I think what it's going to do for a lot of farmers, it's just going to mean that they're going to push their trays out. And we're not just talking about apples. We're talking about everything that's in the fresh fruit and vegetable category at Coles and Woolworths, because that's all under the horticultural award. So it's a big issue, whether it's your bananas, your broccoli, your cabbages, your oranges. So it's not just apples that we're talking about.
So potentially, if this is introduced and trees are being pushed out, I mean, we could become net importers of some of these fruits and vegetables.
Well, we hope not. We're going to work as hard as we can for that not to happen, but there comes a point where it's no longer profitable to do it.
Does it apply to all workers, Paul Good? Australian workers or those on a range of different visas who are working on these farms?
It'll apply across the board, Belinda, to everyone.
Okay, and where do you draw most of your workforce from?
Look, we have a lot of backpackers, and then we also bring in a fantastic group of Tongan workforce on a Pacific Island program. And to talk about the Tongans for a second, these guys come in and they're here for about 4 or 5 months. They want to average about 60 hours a week. They take all that money home to Tonga. I think the average household income in Tonga is about $5,000 a year. So these guys are earning sort of $1,500, $2,000 a week while they're here. They work bloody hard. They will not come if I can only pay them 38 hours a week. And that's a really big problem for our business if those guys can't come back.
All right, so you're a big player in the industry. You're also on the board of Australian Apple and Pears. What's the plan? How do you fight this?
We've just got to start talking to our pollies. I think the biggest thing is it's just been, I think it's still alluded to, it's just been slowly bubbling away in the back rooms of Fair Work. The first thing is that all horticultural growers in Australia need to understand what's about to impact them, because most of them don't understand what's about to happen. So the first thing is public awareness.
Paul Good. Thanks for talking to us today. Appreciate that. Paul Good, he is from Newton Orchards at Manjimup and also on the APEL board, talking about how the Fair Work Commission is now having a good look at overtime and looking at the fruit, veggie sector. And when it comes to that 38-hour week and the workers reach that point, the Fair Work Commission thinking that maybe that's the point where overtime is paid. Vic Grisotis grows avocados and apples. He also has a packing and cold store facility on his farm in Manjimup. Now, Vic, your operations are a little on the smaller scale to what we just heard from Paul. Can you tell us what happens at your place?
Good afternoon, Belinda. Yes, we are a relatively small operation, a mum and dad family operation. We grow apples and avocados, plus we also commercially pack some apples and store fruit for other growers. And, we're concerned about the way, we're facing all these escalating costs, not only in wages, but power costs and fuel costs. So we're really facing the cost price squeeze, and this additional increase in this current thing with labour, we're looking at what can we do, and we're actually downsizing our operation, and diversifying. So what we're trying to now do is we used to be once 100% apple growers. And, as Paul said, it's quite an intense harvest period with high labour requirement. We've now taken a very conscious action to say, how can we reduce the pressure on our labour harvest? And so what we've done is, we've more than halved our packing, our growing operation in apples, and are diversifying into avocados, and we're currently looking at putting lemons. And what we're trying to do is to have a range of multiple crops where we are removing this intense labour requirement, and therefore, A, it gives us an opportunity to do more ourselves as a family and take labour out. But we're also looking at technology, harvesting machines. Anything that removes labour, we are, as far as we are concerned, is a positive in our business. It represents our biggest cost structure, and we are actively pursuing to get rid of labour in whatever way we can. And an increase like this, that's just going to facilitate the speed at which we make change.
Vic, really good to get your perspective this afternoon. Thank you for that. Vic Grisotis is an avocado and apple grower and has his farm set up in Manjimup, talking about the possibility of when a worker hits that 38-hour in the week mark, getting overtime at that point and what it would mean to a business like Vic's. ABC WA, 6 minutes to 1. Just before the markets today, the company looking to build a mega prawn farm on Lejeune Station just near the WANT border has lured in some investment from a major Japanese seafood company. Nisui is investing $25 million into the Sea Farms Group, with the expectation that it's going to start construction on Project Sea Dragon this year. Sea Farms is yet to make a final investment decision on the project, but if it goes ahead, it'll be one of the world's biggest prawn farms, capable of churning out 100,000 tonnes of black tiger prawns each year. Matt Brand spoke to Seafarm's Executive Director Chris Mitchell and asked what the Nisui investment means to the company.
Well, Nisui will invest $25 million in Seafarms in exchange for about 15% of its equity. They'll be able to appoint a director and they'll have top-up rights to maintain that level of equity. But it also means that they'll take 15% of our existing production in Queensland and take between 10 to 20% of production from Project Sea Dragon at market-based prices. So this is a very detailed set of arrangements. It's good because it ensures that product can move offshore to export markets. And, of course, it's the first tranche of equity in Project Sea Dragon.
In today's statement to the ASX, Seafarms says that Nisui will assist in the development of Project Sea Dragon. Can you explain that?
That's right. Well, we've always said Project Sea Dragon is an integrated development. Nisui obviously has a lot of expertise. They'll have a member on the board. But in particular, we're also looking at branding opportunities, making sure the product is sold in markets at the premium for which it deserves. And we'll be producing very high-quality prawns for international markets. And Nisui has expertise in branding and sales.
What does this mean in terms of starting construction on Project Sea Dragon? Because the company still hasn't made a final investment decision.
That's right. Well, this is a major step forward towards a financial investment decision. We've clearly got to put the rest of the finance in place to get started. We're aiming to get started this year in the dry. However, that does depend on locking everything in.
Seafarm Executive Director Chris Mitchell talking about the Japanese seafood company Nisui deciding to invest $25 million into his company. Nisui, one of the world's largest seafood producers, having over 9,000 people working for it around the world in wild caught fisheries, aquaculture, and also in the processing business. 3 minutes to 1, about 19,500 sheep sold at last week's Katanning sheep sale. Tracy Kilner, how did today's yarding go?
Hi, Belinda. Numbers were down this week. We had 18,727 sheep. The quality of all categories was very mixed. Prices for prime lambs was firm to up, with the lightweight lambs gaining $3 to $10 on last week. Heavyweight lambs in score 3 condition in the carcass weight range of 23 to 26 kilos made from $137 to $152 a head to return $5.52 to $6.13 a kilo carcass weight. Trade weight lambs in the 18 to 22 kilo range made from $115 to $144 to return $580 to $640 per kilo, including skins. Score 1 and 2 lightweight weather lambs made from $26 to $104, depending on their frame and skin value, and the crossbred lambs went to feeders and processors at $68 to $118, with the extremely poor drafts from $5 to $60 a head. Mutton prices were strong, with the heavyweight ewes in the 24 to 30 kilo carcass weight range making from $100 to $145 including skins. That's $3 to $20 up on last week to return $339 to $428 a kilo carcass weight. The lighter score 2 boning ewes down to 15 kilos carcass weight made from $60 to $80, with the very light ewes selling for $15 to $55 a head. Good medium weight ewes in the 18 to 22 kilo carcass weight made from $80 to $100, including skins, to remain firm. The quality of the black tag ewes was mixed this week along with their values. The best drafts made from $105 to $118 and the light plain ewes sold for $25 to $90 a head. Good numbers of weathers saw prices gain. Best lines made from $96 to $140 to processors and live exporters, and most of the light and medium weight weathers were purchased by processors and some graziers at $50 to $87 a head. Mature rams sold to processors for $60 to $70 and up to $97 a head to live export. Store rams made as little as $10 to $50 a head. The best of the ram lambs sold to feeder buyers to $133 and live export for $105 a head. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you very much for that, Tracy. And tomorrow, Thursday, Tracy back with the details of the Mount Barker cattle market. This from a concerned truckie Hi, Belinda. Just a comment on the burning taking place on the Stirling Ranges today. I don't know if DFES or Parks and Wildlife have checked the forecast, but burning the Stirlings would be the last thing you would do before 50-kilometre winds the following day. Absolutely ridiculous. Thank you for that, concerned Truckee. We'll keep an eye on that weather and that front on its way, going through in a lot of detail with the Bureau for you tomorrow here on the Country Hour. Time for the news, 1 o'clock.